A comet zooms through a night sky. Stars glimmer, then turn to numbers. A galaxy of stars speeds past. Geometric circles and lines flash up. The numbers turn to letters. Studio Canal. On a black background, EMI Film Productions Limited. A slender woman in a red satin dress, which is off her shoulders and trimmed with black, walks about a Victorian room. She pushes a rocking horse in the room and it rocks to and fro. She then sets a magic lantern turning and an image of a dove appears to fly. The Railway Children, from the celebrated novel by E. Nesbitt. A young woman who has a swan-like neck and her hair elegantly piled on top of her head looks around the softly lit room. A photograph of an elegant woman in a large hat sits on a desk with a red book and an inkwell. Miss Dinah Sheridan. A photograph of a station master, a golden spyglass in a case, a red box with Foreign Office on it in gold letters and the name C. Waterbury. Mr. Bernard Cribbins, Mr. William Mervyn, Mr. Ian Cuthbertson. Miss Jenny Agata, Miss Sally Tomsett, Master Gary Warren, as the Railway Children. A toy steam engine with a polished brass boiler sits on the floor among old photos. Director of Photography, Arthur Ibbotson, BSc. The horn of an early gramophone gleams. Music composed and conducted by Johnny Douglas. Screenplay by Lionel Jeffries. Produced by Robert Lynn. A toy theatre with characters and furniture on stage. A set of Punch and Judy puppets. Directed by Lionel Jeffries. The magic lantern stops spinning.
We were not the railway children to begin with. I don't suppose we ever thought about railways, except as a means of getting to the theatre and zoo. We were just ordinary suburban children, and we lived with father and mother in an ordinary red brick fronted villa with coloured glass in the front door.
Oh, come on.
A tiled passage that was called a hall, and big fires in big fireplaces. We even had a gas fire in the breakfast room and a servant's bellboard.
A copper boiler over a bath.
In fact, every modern convenience.
Sit up!
The railway children pose for a photo.
There were three of us.
Let's arrange your pretty hair.
That's me. I'm Roberta. They call me Bobby. Sometimes Lanky. I'm the eldest, worst luck. That's Phyllis, who means well. And that's Peter, who wants to be an engineer.
And don't forget to watch the Dicky Bird.
The elderly gent raises his flash. He screws up his eyes. The bird on top of the flash burns. A riverside picnic.
Mother did not spend all her time in paying dull calls to dull ladies and sitting dully at home waiting for dull ladies to pay calls on her. She was always there with us.
A tall, bearded man wearing a top hat gets out of a carriage outside the villa.
It was just perfect.
The family are at the theatre.
And if it goes out, that means she's dead. She said she would get well again if children believed in fairies. Do you believe in fairies?
Yes!
That's not loud enough. Do you believe in fairies?
Yes!
Still not loud enough. Do you believe in fairies?
Yes!
Yes, I certainly do!
The children's father, Mr. Waterbury, calls out. At home, Mr. Waterbury cuts a turkey.
It smells gorgeous. It's fabulous. Absolutely fabulous.
Oh, Aunt, isn't this delicious? I don't...
Oh, it's
so
nice.
Now, all together. One, two, three.
They blow out flames on a Christmas pudding. Potts the sheepdog wears a pink bow. Bobby feeds him from her hand.
I love you.
Father's dressed as Santa.
I think that we ought to have been very happy. And we were, but we did not know how happy. Till the pretty life at Edgecombe Villa was over and done with. And we had to live a very different life indeed.
Thank you, sir.
Peter, my boy, come here.
Mr. Waterbury presents Peter with a green and brass steam engine, which has a red bow tied round it. Peter holds it in both hands and stares down at it, then looks up at his father.
It's perfect. It's more perfect than anyone could ever dream of.
Peter is about 10 years old.
Thank you, Dad.
Peter plays with the engine.
The dreadful change came quite suddenly.
The children and Potts watch the engine stop on its track and steam violently. Potts runs past maids cleaning the doorstep.
You lazy brute!
And that was the last we saw of poor Potts.
What a wreck!
Is there any hope?
Hope? Of course it'll want hope. And a new valve. I tell you what, I'll give up Saturday afternoon to it. Yes, and you can help me.
I hate doing a job like this, especially at Christmas.
Yeah. Who on earth's that? An Englishman's house is his castle, but I do wish they'd build him with moats and drawbridges, eh? Come in. Yes?
Please, sir, there are two gentlemen wish to see you. I've shown them into the study, sir. I hope that was all right.
Excuse me.
Mr. Waterbury pats his wife and goes. Ruth, the maid, follows him. The children watch him go. Mr. Waterbury strides to the study. He looks taken aback and shuts the door.
I wish we did have a moat and drawbridge. Then if we didn't want anyone to...
I've never heard of it. Where?
Who? Why is Daddy shouting?
I don't know, dear. Come in. Yes, Ruth?
Red-haired Ruth lowers her eyes.
Please, ma'am, the master wants you to just step into the study.
Elegant Mrs. Waterbury gets up and throws Ruth an uneasy glance as she leaves the room. Ruth, who wears a black and white uniform and has coarse, bulbous features, glances back at the children balefully and follows her out.
I don't... Look, I'm not at all interested at all in anything you have to say at this stage. I'm not prepared to say a thing.
Come in.
I will not. Let me see the bit.
Mrs. Waterbury enters. The children earwig and creep closer. The children run across a corridor, then creep near to the study, keeping close to the wall. All three children's faces at different heights peer round an archway and see their father come out into the hallway. He puts on his top hat and coat. Phyllis, who's about 11, watches in horror, her mouth agape, her dark eyes wide. Mr. Waterbury kisses his wife on the cheek. Peter, who has a shock of brown hair in a fringe, watches wide-eyed. Snow falls as Mrs. Waterbury observes the two men lead her husband to a horse-drawn cab, which is waiting outside the villa in the night.
Scotland Yard.
All three get into the cab. Mrs. Waterbury slowly closes the front door. Looking shocked and tearful, she leans back against the door. The children come out of hiding and gather around her.
Bedtime. Ruth will put you to bed.
But you promised we could stay up late. Daddy was going to play with us.
Father's been called away on business. Go up at once, darlings, please.
All three file upstairs obediently. Bobby, the last and aged about 14, hangs back and turns solemnly to her mother.
It wasn't bad news, was it, Mummy? Is anyone dead, or...?
No, nobody's dead. I can't tell you anything about it tonight. Up you go.
Bobby obeys. Mrs. Waterbury, a slender lady wearing an elegant grey dress with white lace collar and cuffs, turns and stares into the study, which has shelves of neatly stacked books. She stands with her hands resting on the doorposts and her head bowed.
96, 97, 98, 99, 100.
Ruth brushes Phyllis's, or Phil's, long dark hair. Wearing a nightdress, Phil removes her slippers and gets into bed. Ruth turns out the gas lights.
Good night, then.
Bobby is in another bed in the room. Ruth walks along a landing. She turns to see Peter.
What's up?
Ask me no questions and I'll tell you no lies. You'll know soon enough.
Middle-aged Ruth smiles smugly. Mrs. Waterbury enters the girls' room. She bends over and kisses Phil's cheek tenderly. Phil's eyes are closed. She then does the same to Bobby. Neither girl stirs. Mrs. Waterbury leaves the dark room with a sob. Bobby half sits up in bed.
Phil. Yes. If Mother doesn't want us to know she's been crying, then we won't know. That's all. All right.
Bobby buries her face in her pillow. Phil bites back tears and pulls the covers over her head. Breakfast time.
She's gone into London, that's all I know. Now just you eat up.
Ruth leaves the room.
I just know it.
Gas lamps are lit and it's dusk when Mrs. Waterbury walks along the pleasant street to their villa. The children watch her from a window. Their mother walks as if in a trance and looks sad. She ignores a passing gentleman who raises his hat to her.
Good evening, Mrs. Waterbury.
She looks up at the house tearfully and pauses. Sally opens up. The children rush to meet their mother.
Good evening, Ma.
Good evening.
Oh, it's so cold. Let's get to the farm,
Peter. Come on.
My darlings, those men last night did bring very bad news, and Father will be away for some time.
Is it something to do with the government, Mummy?
Yes. Yes, it is. Now it's bedtime, my darlings.
The children get up and make to go.
Don't worry. It'll all come right in the end.
Don't you worry either, because we'll be as good as gold.
They go. Mrs. Waterbury's tearful. Phil and Bobby sit in their bedroom. Both wear pretty white smocks.
I used to say life was so dull. Nothing ever happened like in books. Now something has happened.
Yes, it has. And it's made Mother unhappy. Everything's horrid. Just horrid.
Stairs, stairs, stairs.
Everything continued to be perfectly horrid for some weeks. Mother was nearly always out. The between maid was sent away.
Sally weeps as Mrs. Waterbury kisses her goodbye. Sally takes her case and hurries out.
And Aunt Emma came on a visit.
Aunt Emma stands at the villa's front door. She wears a white pith helmet with a long chiffony scarf around it and a long white jacket and skirt. Ruth opens the door and Emma strides in. The children peer through banister rails as their stern-faced, grey-haired aunt speaks to them.
Good afternoon, children.
Good afternoon, Aunt Emma.
Aunt Emma.
Your mother has sent for me in her distress, and I'm here for a while, but not for long. I'm off to India as a governess, and as I shall be busy preparing for my arduous journey, I shall require you to be seen and not heard. Preferably to be not seen and not heard. Children should be kept in their proper places. Do you understand?
Yes, Aunt Emma.
Yes, Aunt Emma.
Excellent. You may kiss me, if you wish.
Now gathered around her, the children hesitate. Peter grimaces. He and Bobby urge Phil on, and she obeys. Cook in a bowler hat.
Use them utensils in that manner. I was up at 4 o'clock this morning cleaning them. As if I haven't got enough to do. What with the between maid leaving? And now your aunt asking me to eat blooming great boxes about. Like I was a navvy or something.
Ruth?
Yes?
There's no need to
to be so rude. Cook was just trying to cheer us up. Come on, you two.
Bobby hands Ruth a spoon she was using to beat time and goes, followed by Peter and Phil.
I'm very surprised at you, Cook.
Where's your dignity? And take that silly hat off. Get yourself dressed properly. I don't know, I seem to do all the work round here.
A bucket of water over a door.
She'll get soaked.
It's too late. She's coming.
Stairs. And I've fallen arches before me, Holiday. I hope you're undressed and ready, Master Peter. I haven't got all night, you know.
Yes, Ruth.
God. Oh! Oh! Oh!
Phew. The bucket of water was balanced on top of the partly open bathroom door and fell on Ruth as she entered, soaking her. The children cower against the bath as Ruth approaches with her eyes narrowed in a malevolent and maniacal smile. She slowly lifts her arm, ready to strike. The children huddle together as they cower. Ruth lashes out at Peter and slaps him across the face. Mrs. Waterbury stands sternly in the doorway. Mrs. Waterbury sees Ruth out. Ruth looks Mrs. Waterbury up and down snootily and walks out. A reprimanding look from their mother stops the children applauding. She tuts and smiles.
We're going to have to play at being poor for a while. We're moving to a darling little house in the country, up in Yorkshire.
What?
I know you'll love it.
Is Aunt Emma coming?
No, Peter, unfortunately not.
Night. A passenger greets the family as they get onto a train.
No, second. Thank you.
You're right, first class, following to me.
Are we on the right train for Yorkshire?
Yes, thank you.
Mrs. Waterbury puts belongings on a rack above their seats. The train sets off. Steam billows from the engine's funnel as it puffs along through the night, and moonlight reflects off water. The train pulls up at a dark, damp platform in countryside. A miserable-faced man waits with a cart and horse. Mrs. Waterbury gets out of the train.
Careful. Give that to me.
She takes one of the larger bags. The children get off the train carrying luggage. Bobby takes a bag from the male passenger.
Thank you so much.
Bye. Thank you. Goodbye.
Excuse me.
The horse and cart man.
We want to go to the house on the hill, the Three Chimneys. Do you know the way?
I dare say.
Well, will you show us?
I dare say. High up.
Without looking at them, he moves off, and the Waterburys follow on foot, carrying their luggage.
Oh, Phil, is you all right?
Yes.
Can't we put just one box on your cart?
You asked me to show you the way. Nothing was said about boxes.
Never mind, darlings. It's only a few more yards.
Oh.
He pulls the horse up and the family climb over a stile in a wall to the house.
I wonder why she didn't leave the lights on.
Who's she?
Mrs. Viney, the woman I engaged to clean the place and to get the supper.
Expect Mrs. Viney's gone home. Your train was late, see?
But she's got the key. What do we do?
She'd have left that under the doorstep. We all do hereabouts.
Well, you might have said so.
You never asked, did you? Nothing was said about a door key.
May I borrow your lamp, please?
I dare say.
If you say I dare say once more, I shall have hysterics, I dare say.
Oh. There we are.
The oil lamp lights the dark interior. Water drips from a tap, and rodents scuttle around surfaces.
What's that?
It's only the rats.
The bearded carrier, who wears a hood pulled up over his head, enters the house. He snootily takes back his lamp from Mrs. Waterbury and starts to make his way out. He turns back. He's blind in one eye.
God works in mysterious ways, his wonders to perform.
The carrier goes, leaving them all in the dark.
Ow! Rats! Wish we had a car. Don't you worry, darlings. I saw a paraffin lamp on the table. We'll soon have some light.
Oh, those poor little mice. They were so frightened. I don't believe they were rats at all.
She lights the lamp.
You often said you wanted something to happen. Well, now it has. It's quite exciting, isn't it? I told Mrs. Viney to get some meat and bread and have some supper ready. I wonder where. Oh, I suppose she's laid it in the dining room. Come along, darlings. Up here. Let's go and see. Come along. Oh, darlings. Mind the steps. Mind how you go, Peter.
They step through a curtain. She tries a door and it's locked. They look in what seems to be a cupboard.
Oh, that beastly woman. She's taken the money and not left us any food.
Are we going to have any supper tonight? I'm starving.
I know. There's some food in the cases in the cellar. Aunt Emma sent them on ahead of us. I think it's this way. Come along. Mind it. Mind the step.
Bobby turns on the phonograph. The family are eating.
Come along, Bobby. It's a real feast. Sardines, biscuits, ginger, raisins. No, Phil, no, you do not put the marmalade spoon into the sardines.
Mm, well, it's gorgeous, Mummy.
Tell you what, let's drink Aunt Emma's health. Good idea.
Here's to Aunt Emma.
To Aunt Emma.
Aunt Emma.
And all who sail in her.
A sunny day. A breeze rustles flowers outside the stone house. At breakfast.
Pie!
Pie?
Apple pie!
Apple pie for breakfast? Then we're not poor after all.
This is the supper we should have had. I found it this morning in that little room that we thought was a cupboard. So Mrs. Viney wasn't so bad after all.
They all look towards the door. Mrs. Waterbury goes to answer it. Bobby finishes cutting the pie.
Good morning. Can I help you?
I expect so, mum. Viney's the name.
Hilda Viney, mum. Mrs.
Do come in. We've just been talking about you.
Oh, I see. You found your supper then. Funny time to have it, though.
The children run and skip through a field of tall grass and buttercups. Above them, a blue sky dotted with clouds. They run to a wooden fence, climb on it, and sit on the top. It overlooks a railway line and tunnel. As an engine steams out of the tunnel, a fireman stokes the boiler's roaring fire with coal. Sitting on the fence at the top of an embankment, the children watch the train streak past, steam gushing from its funnel. The train glides off.
It was like a great dragon tearing by.
A dragon's house looks like that tunnel.
I never thought we'd ever get so near to a train as this. It's better than toy engines, isn't it?
Don't know. It's different. It seems so odd to see all of a train. It's so tall. I've always seen them cut in half by platforms. I wonder if that train's going to London. London's where Daddy is.
We don't know that, Phil.
He might be.
They jump down from the fence. The children run down a narrow track from the top of the embankment to the railway line. They look up and down the track, then walk along the sleepers. The girls wear their white smocks over their clothes and woolen hats on the back of their heads. Peter wears breeches, knee-high socks, shirt and tie and a jacket. There's a muffin-like flat cap on his head. He walks ahead towards the station. The girls follow him. They walk up onto the sunny platform. Peter looks over a fence at a pile of coal in a yard. There's a white mark round the coal. The name Oakworth is painted on grass on the opposite side of the track. Peter pokes his head in a doorway and comes out again. Hanging baskets and tubs planted up with flowers adorn the platform. The children walk on and look through a window. They go to look through the porter's room window. A man in uniform sleeps with his face beneath a newspaper. He leaps up out of his seat at the sound.
How do you do?
Yes.
Could I ask you two questions?
Yeah, well, it does depend what they are. I can't spend all day conversationalizing with the junior public. Now, what are they?
Well, firstly, what's that white mark on the coal heap for, please?
Yo, that's to tell how much coal there is, you see, in case anybody nicks it. Second question, please.
Do you know anything about engines?
Do I know anything about engines? Why?
Because I've got one.
Got what gauge?
Oh, I don't know anything about gauges, but it's about this big.
Yes?
It's brass, and it blew up!
It blew up? Well, just excuse me, young man. I've got a lot to do, because the station master's having his hair cut in Leeds, you see. And Perks must be about it.
Perks? Who's Perks?
Me, sir. I'm Perks.
The children watch Perks as he hurriedly opens the gates of a level crossing. Wearing a Kepi-style peaked hat, he then goes to a large lever and pushes it forward. He pulls another lever back, then smiles and checks his pocket watch.
Right on time!
What is?
This here is! The Scots Flyer!
Perks, a mustachioed man, raises his hat high as the train rolls through the station. Phil cowers and huddles into Bobby. Perks changes the points back with the levers.
Why is it going so slowly, Mr. Perks?
Well, it's all uphill to Scotland, isn't it?
That train's going to Scotland. If Daddy's not in London, he's in Scotland. And that train's going to Scotland.
Perhaps, Phil.
Double bed, Phil wears her woolen hat.
I don't think we're going to enjoy being poor. You know, being cold and all that.
Oh, Phyllis, try to imagine it as an adventure. All sorts of things might happen. Mother could write about it. Write a book. You never know. We won't always be poor, Phyllis. I'm sure.
All right. Good night.
Good night.
Bobby turns out a paraffin lamp.
Still cold, though.
Likely on the cheek. One of the men in a bowler hat opened the door. Father did not turn, but left without a word.
Mrs. Waterbury sits up in bed writing. She wears sawn-off mittens and a shawl. She coughs delicately. Day. A train steams through green countryside bisected by stone walls. The children sit on the fence waiting.
Why don't we ask the next train to take our love to Daddy?
Trains don't carry people's love. They'd be above that.
Yes, they do if you tame them first. I wonder why Daddy hasn't written to us.
Mummy says he's too busy. He'll write soon, she says.
Well, why don't we wave anyway? Three waves won't matter. We won't miss them.
As the train passes, the children raise their hankies and wave. In the back of a rear carriage, an elderly balding gentleman with white hair waves his folded newspaper in response. He has a chubby red face and a ready smile. There are glasses and a decanter on his table.
Charming.
He reads his newspaper. Night. In his room, Peter, dressed in woolly hat and thick clothes, lays his pillows beneath the blankets to make the form of a body. He turns off his paraffin lamp and makes stealthily for his bedroom door. He opens it, pauses, then goes out. Peter runs out of the house and down to the station. He stands on top of the pile of coal and looks about. He then crouches down and begins to put lumps of coal into his hat. Perks is locking up the station as Peter slips and scarpers. Perks hears and ponders.
About time they had it seen to.
Next day, the children sit round the breakfast table.
Held out well, Bobby. There was hardly any there yesterday when I looked.
Well, we've only had one far.
I know. I could swear there's more than when we first came.
That's silly.
Of course it's silly.
Peter notices his grubby hand and conceals it beneath the table, wiping it on his trousers. Night. Peter collects coal in an old pram. A wheel comes off as he drags it away. He gathers up chunks of coal and runs off, Bobby and Phil outside in the dark.
So it's you, Pete. It's you.
It's me what?
It's you that's been putting the coal in the shed. But where from, Pete, for heaven's sake?
From the coal heap, of course. They've got stacks of it there.
But that's stealing. Don't you remember your catechism? Thou shalt not steal, says the Lord.
Wasn't stealing, it was mining. I took it from the top. That's mining, not stealing. If it was, all the miners in the world would be in jug.
Oh, Pete. Pete.
Oh, Pete. Pete.
We'll have to take it all back.
What?
All of it.
All of it.
All of it.
All of it. There can't be anything wrong in trying to keep your own mother warm. That can't be wrong. It's all right, Pete. At least we can burn the evidence.
A dull, gusty day. Peter, carrying a paper bag, runs down a track to the house. Mrs. Viney opens the door as he arrives.
Mrs. Viney, here we are. I've got the buns for tea.
Buns?
Yes, Mummy's old story and... Mrs. Viney, what's the matter?
Oh, it's your dear ma, Master Peter. She's very poorly. You better go back to the village and get Dr. Forrest.
Right. Don't let her die, Mrs. Viney!
Stark trees in a graveyard. Peter runs around and over the stones, then stands on a raised tomb to look out at a grand house opposite. Whiskery Dr. Forrest is lying on the grass. He quickly pockets a bottle and sits up.
Mother's very ill. Please come quickly.
Stay there, my boy.
Forrest quickly collects his medical bag from inside the house, then, putting his arm round Peter's shoulder, hurries away down a path to the house gate. They leave and he closes the gate behind them. Mrs. Waterbury, her face glowing with sweat and her eyes closed, lies in bed. Mrs. Viney is sitting on the bedside. Forrest and Peter set off in a horse and trap. Mrs. Viney and the children are outside Mrs. Waterbury's bedroom when Forrest comes out.
Influenza. But not serious.
He turns to Bobby.
Now, my Lady Graveairs, I suppose you want to be head nurse.
Of course, Doctor.
Right. Now, we'll send down some medicine. Keep a good fire going and have some strong beef tea ready to give her the moment the fever goes down. She can have the grapes now and the soda water and the milk. Oh, and you better get a bottle of brandy. You can go in.
May I have the list?
She takes it. Mother is sitting up in bed. To Phil.
Don't worry, funny face. She's head nurse. But you can be matron.
Oh, thank you.
And nonsense, I can't afford all that.
I haven't an idea in my head for a story, so there won't even be buns for tea for some time. Now, tell Mrs. Viney to boil 2 pounds of scrag end of neck for your dinner tomorrow, and then I'll have some of the broth.
But even if we never have anything to eat at all, you can't afford all those other things.
Right. So we've got to think of some other way. Now, everybody, think. Just as hard as ever you can. Think.
No.
I-O-N.
You sure?
Yes.
I. O. N. Oh, there. Brilliant. Look out at the station.
Definitely one of your best works, Michelangelo.
Phil has painted a big sign on a white sheet. Peter nails the sign to the fence as a train makes its way down the track. The elderly gentleman, in his usual car at the rear, looks up from reading his newspaper and sees the large sign. Peter points to the sign as the train glides past trees into dappled sunlight. Phil searches along the carriages as the train pulls up. She sees the old man pop his head out.
You are the man that waves to us, aren't you?
One of yours, please!
Aren't you?
Yes, my dear, I wave.
Oh, will you take this, please? We chose you because we thought you had such a kind face.
Man the doors, please, miss. On the way, Mr. Mitchell!
Thank you, Mr. Burt.
With a few flourishes of the guard's flag, the train sets off. Phil and the old man exchange waves. Perks touches his hat to the old boy. Wearing a white smock, black stockings and her woolly hat, Phil runs off along the platform and out of the station. On the train, the gentleman reads the note he's been given, smiles, and puts it back in its envelope. Perks, in his early 40s and with a good-humoured long face, wears a black suit and bowler, along with a white shirt and black tie. He's pedalling a tricycle with a trailer on the back. In it is a hamper. Perks draws to a halt sedately and gets off the tricycle. He struggles to lift the hamper up, then finds it won't go through the gap or stile in the Waterbury's garden wall. He heaves the wickerwork hamper up and rests it over the gap. Perks then carefully removes his hat, places it on top of the hamper, and crawls beneath the hamper and through the stile. Once on the other side, he puts his hat back on, lifts the hamper, and hobbles to the house with it.
Good evening.
Evening.
Good evening.
Oh, dear. Oh, good evening. The name's Perks. I believe we've met.
Oh, yes, of course. You were busy because of the station master being in Leeds.
Yes, even busier now, because he had a drop too much down at the Britannia Arms and fell over and broke his daft leg playing billiards. Of course, it was his own fault.
Why?
Well, he should have used the rest, you know. He will do that over the edge, you see. Well, the old gent asked me to fetch this up straight away.
Oh, thank you very much, Mr. Perks. I'm very sorry I haven't got tuppence to give you like Father does, but...
Hey, just stop that, please. I wasn't thinking about no tuppences. No, I just came to say I was sorry to hear your mama wants so well and to ask how she finds herself this evening. Oh, and I've brought her a bit of sweetbriar there. It's very sweet to smell, that is.
He takes it out of his hat.
Very much. I beg your pardon about the
time. No offence, I'm sure. No offence. Just to show, I'll have a look at that little blown-up brass engine of yours, shall I?
What?
Here.
Peter races off.
Can you manage? Bit of it.
Here. Peter returns.
Oh, that's it. Bit of a mess, isn't it? Still, I'll see what I can do. Good evening.
Thank you, Mr. Perks. Good night.
He goes and the children crouch beside the hamper. Bobby and Phil undo the leather straps on it and open the lid a crack.
Oh, how nice. Oh, it's such a
kiss. Oh, it's
a kiss. Dear Roberta, Phyllis and Peter, here are the things you want. Your mother will want to know where they came from, so please ask her to forgive me for taking the liberty of allowing myself a great pleasure. Yours sincerely, G.P. something. I can't read it.
I think we were right to ask him.
Right? Of course we're right.
I don't fancy telling Mother the whole truth about this.
We shouldn't do that till she's completely well. And when she is, we'll be so happy we shan't mind the fuss. Oh, look at those roses. I'll take them up to her.
Phil holds out Perks's gift.
Sweet flower.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, look, I wonder what's in there.
The elderly gentleman in his usual seat on the train. Steam swirls outside the carriage and evaporates. He looks out and now sees a painted sign up which reads, "She is well, thank you." The man exchanges waves with the children.
So that's an end to it. Now listen, it's quite true that we're poor, but we shall have enough to live on just so long as I have ideas for stories. But you mustn't go about telling people of our affairs. It isn't right. And you must never, never, never ask strangers to give you things. Always remember that.
Yes, sir.
I shall write to your old gentleman. I shall tell him that I didn't approve. Oh, I shall thank him, too, of course, for his kindness. But it's you that I don't approve of, not the old gentleman. He's been extremely kind. You can give my letter to your Mr. Perks to give to him. And you won't say any more about it.
She's marvellous when she's angry.
Trees cast dappled sunlight on a road as Forrest, wearing a black top hat and frock coat, drives his horse and cart. A shallow river flanks the track, and a low stone bridge with two arches spans the water. Bobby's sitting with her legs dangling over the side of the bridge. Dr. Forrest pulls up.
Hello, head nurse.
That's funny. I was thinking about you. I wanted to talk to you, Doctor.
Your mother's not worse, I hope.
No, but...
Come on, we'll go for a ride.
He flicks the reins and the horse crosses to the other side of the river. Forrest pulls up again and Bobby joins him. He offers her a gloved hand and she climbs up into the cart to sit beside him. Two little girls with grubby faces, who sit on a wall eating apples, watch as the doctor and Bobby drive off towards a street of stone houses. One of the little girls waves. On a hillside track...
This is great fun.
Now come on, out with it, head nurse. What's the trouble?
It's rather hard, you see, to out with it. Because of what Mother said.
What did Mother say?
She said I wasn't to go telling everyone that we're poor. But you aren't everyone, are you?
Not at all. Well?
Well, I know doctors are very expensive. And Mrs. Viney told me that her doctoring only cost her tuppence a week. Because she belonged to a club.
Yes?
Well, could we join your club too, please? The same as Mrs. Viney. You aren't cross with me, are you?
Cross? How could I be cross with you? You're a very sensible little woman. Now, look here, don't you worry. I'll make it all right with your mother, even if I have to make a special brand new club just for her.
Boo!
They pull up at the Waterbury's.
Thank you.
She gets down and goes inside.
Bobby, you ought to tidy yourself up in here. Here's a new ribbon for you. There, that's to show the surprise is ready. Oh, when the bell rings again, you can come into the dining room. Come, Pete.
Bobby looks at the ribbon and thinks for a moment.
Of course.
Bobby smiles and hurriedly removes her smock to reveal a lavender dress. She puts the matching ribbon in her long brown hair. Forrest, still in his cart outside, rushes to a door. Bobby finishes tying the bow in her hair and runs to the bottom of a short flight of stairs. She stops and composes herself, then walks sedately along a corridor towards the dining room. She opens the door. The room is decked with decorations and a fire glows in a grate. Bobby, a slender, beautiful young woman, looks around in wonder at the tinkling, colourful baubles which gleam brightly in the firelight. Dr. Forrest, Mrs. Viney, Mother, Peter, Phil and Perks all stand smiling at her in the soft light. Bobby slowly steps into the room and approaches Forrest, who smiles, kisses her hand, and then gives her a small box.
Happy birthday, Hepness.
She moves on to Mrs. Viney, who curtsies and offers a small package covered in red paper and bows.
Happy birthday, Miss Roberta.
Bobby moves on to her mother, who stands beside a table of party food, Mrs. Waterbury's eyes well with tears.
My darling.
She offers her cheek to Bobby, then hands her a small gift. Peter proudly holds out an iced birthday cake with one tall lit candle on it. Bobby tries to blow out the flame but can't. From Phil, a garland and a hug.
Happy birthday, Lanky.
She was beautiful as a butterfly, proud as a queen, was pretty little Polly Perkins of Paddington Green. Many happy returns.
Thank you.
Perks toasts her.
Fat. I hope you enjoy the cake.
It's lovely. Thank you very much.
Have a lovely party, my dear.
Thank you for coming. Thank you.
Mrs. Viney and Dr. Forrest leave. Bobby's eyes brim with tears.
Wouldn't Daddy have loved this?
Mrs. Waterbury nuzzles her forehead tenderly against Bobby's.
Thank you very much, Mrs. Waterbury. Good night. Good night. Happy birthday! Hey, happy birthday!
The colourful posy of flowers Perks bought Bobby lies on her and Phil's double bed along with the other gifts. Phil lies eyes closed beneath the blankets, while Bobby, in a red nightdress, sits studying one of her gifts. She suddenly puts a hand to her chest, as if feeling for something, gets off the bed and goes downstairs. She enters the dining room and picks up the buttercup brooch her mother gave her. She makes to leave the room but turns back when she hears her mother sobbing. Mrs. Waterbury sits in an armchair facing the still glowing fire. Bobby begins to approach her, but then turns away and goes back upstairs. Day. Rain lashes the station platform. The children are in the waiting room.
It doesn't get too wet in Wakefield. We don't want it ill again.
It's like being in a besieged castle. The arrows of the foe striking against the battlements.
No, it's more like a great big garden squirt.
You're a great big garden squirt.
Thank you.
Stop it, you two. There's a train coming.
Perks runs out of his room, feels the rain, then goes back for his cape and cap. The train steams towards the station. Perks greets the train.
Over! Over station! Over! Over station! Come along, ladies. Don't mind the rain. It's only a shower. That's it, thank you. Mind the doors, please. Mind the doors now. Through the doors, come on. Right away, Mr. Mainprice.
A man collapses on the platform.
Father should be on the next train in about 15 minutes. That one's from London, I think.
Hey, there's something going on at the end of the station.
Yes, something's happened. Come on.
You ask me, this is a case for the police courts.
No, the infirmary more like.
Let me pass, please. Will you just let me pass? I'll deal with this, if you please.
How are you, Junior?
What's he say?
Sounds like French to me. I was in Calais once for a day.
That's not French.
Well, what is it then, if it's not French?
I don't know. It's not French, I know that. No, that's not French. Nothing like it.
Try him with French if you know so much then, clever dick.
Parlez-vous français, monsieur?
The bearded man rises.
Oh, mon petit, vous ne serez jamais comme je suis content. Dieu vous bénisse.
Now that's French.
What's he say?
I don't know.
Yes, well, all right, everybody. You better just keep moving along, please. Look, I'll deal with this case. Come on, move along.
Thank you. No complaining, no complaining.
All right, no. Go on.
Take him into the waiting room. Mother can talk French, and she's on the next train from Wakefield.
Right, come on.
He pushes Perks away and stands by a wall.
He thinks you're a policeman. He thinks we're going to shut him up. I know he does. Look at his eyes.
They're like a fox's eyes when the beast's in a trap.
Vous êtes Tom. Ma mère parle français. Nous... What's being kind?
Bon is good.
Nous sommes bon pour vous, monsieur.
She puts an arm around him, takes one of his hands and steers him into the waiting room. The kids follow, and Perks, who turns to a man.
Sorry, Malcolm, I'll see you down at Fleece later on. I'll tell you all about it, right, Paul? Aye.
C'est bon. Ma mère arrive. C'est bon. Je vous aide.
Look, I'm not sure we oughtn't to send for police.
Oh, don't. Wait till Mummy comes. She speaks French beautifully. You'll love to hear her.
I'm sure he hasn't done anything like you're sent to prison for.
Yeah, well, he looks without visible means to me. Still, I don't mind waiting till your Mama comes. I must say, I'd like to know what country's got the credit of him. That I should.
Look, I've got an idea. Foreign stamps. We'll show him these.
Regardez les stamps. Quelle patrie?
Ruski. Ruski.
Hello, he's Russian.
Yeah, I thought he was. Da. Ma. Le même. Ruski.
I'll wait here till you bring Mummy in.
Not afraid, miss.
No.
This is Oakwood Station! Mrs. Waterbury! Mrs. Waterbury!
Mummy, we found a Russian!
Close the door! Right away, guys!
You wouldn't hurt me, would you?
He's got this dreadful cough.
Hello, Bobby. Ma mère, qui êtes-vous?
Madame, je m'appelle Chapansky.
Oh, it's all right. Bobby, go and fetch Dr. Forrest. We'll take him home with us. Mr. Perks?
Thank you, madam.
Come on, help him on the other side. Don't worry.
Don't worry, she looks after you. Yeah. Adieu, little Russian.
Forrest is gardening when Bobby pops up from the graveyard.
Doctor. I hate to tell you, Mother's got a very shabby Russian.
Your mother's got a very shabby what?
He'll have to join your club. I'm certain he hasn't any money. We found him at the station.
Found him? Was he lost then?
Yes, that's what he was. He's been telling Mother his life story in French. She said, would you please come directly? He's got a nasty cough. And he's been crying. Oh, don't smile. Please don't. You wouldn't if you'd seen him. I've never seen a man cry before.
Haven't you? I do it all the time.
While Forrest tends the Russian, Mrs. Waterbury opens a trunk marked Charles Waterbury. In it is a newspaper. She takes out a jacket and notices the newspaper. In the same room as Forrest and the Russian, who's in bed, she surreptitiously burns the newspaper in the nearby fire, then takes the jacket over to the bed. Bobby enters the room with logs for the fire and puts them down near the grate. She sees a framed photograph of her father inside the still open trunk and looks at it briefly. Her mother sees and follows her out of the room.
Bobby, I know you said we weren't to ask any questions. But Daddy isn't dead, is he?
Oh, my darling, no.
Bobby, look at me. Daddy was quite well when I heard from him last. And he'll come back to us someday.
She gives Bobby a reassuring smile. Later, Mrs. Waterbury's in bed with her children snuggled around her.
Do tell us about the Russian, Mama.
I can't make a long story of it, darling, because I'm very tired. He's a very clever writer. But in Russia, one dare not say anything about the rich people doing wrong or what ought to be done for the poor. If one does, one is sent to prison. Well, he wrote a book about it all. And he was 3 years in a dungeon. No light, damp and dreadful. Then they took him out and they sent him to Siberia and he was condemned to stay there for life.
For life? For writing a book? That's stupid. Go on, Mama.
While he was at the mines, some friends got a message to him to say that his wife and children had escaped to England. And so after many adventures, he too escaped and came here to look for them.
Do you think he will find them?
Oh, I do hope so. I think, my darlings, in your prayers, you might ask God to show his pity upon all prisoners and captives.
To show his pity upon all prisoners and captives?
Phil prays.
Upon all prisoners and captives.
Day. The Russian, a balding man, over him. Phil brings him a posy of flowers. He smiles and kisses her hand. Bobby and Peter watch from behind a wall. Phil runs back across the rough lawn to her brother and sister.
He seemed pleased. I wish we could think of other things together.
What about strawberries? Pat's promised me some from his own garden ages ago.
They smile and run off. The Russian looks at the posy and smiles. The children stand watching a passing train. When the train's passed, a tree on an embankment starts to slide forward.
Look at that tree over there!
Other trees move with it. The embankment is slipping.
Oh, it's moving. So are the others.
The trees and land slide towards the track.
What is it? What is it?
The children watch from a distance and high up.
It's much too magic for me. I don't like it. I'm going home.
A tree smashes onto wooden planks which shore up the embankment. The planks and the tree block the track. Earth slides down in a cloud of dust. Children stand open-mouthed.
That'll take some sweeping up.
Peter picks his way down a grassy embankment towards the track. His sisters follow gingerly. More earth falls. They step onto the rubble-strewn track.
Hey, the 1129 hasn't
hasn't gone by yet. We must let them know at the station there'll be an accident.
Let's run.
No, come back. It's too late. It's 2 miles away.
We can always climb the telegraph poles and do something to the wires.
Oh, we don't know how.
If we only had something red, we could go down onto the line and wave it.
The train wouldn't see us till it came round the corner. Then it would be too late.
We could go round the corner and wave to the train.
We might wave anyway.
No, they'd only think it was us as usual. We waved so often before.
Flannel petticoats!
Beg your pardon?
Flannel petticoats!
Of course, take them off.
The girls take off their bright red petticoats and run along the track, led by Peter. The train powers ever nearer. Peter takes Phil's petticoat.
Now. You're not going to tear them, Pete!
Oh, shut up! We just tear them into little bits, if you like. Don't you see, Phil, we can't stop the train. There'll be a real-life accident. There'll be people killed.
Now, Sticks, come on.
They head into undergrowth and frantically break off sticks. The petticoats are now on sticks. The driver looks out of the side of the engine, takes off his leather hat and wipes his forehead. The children are on the track.
It was my idea.
There are petticoats for Pete's sake.
What's it matter who waves what? We can only stop the train.
They stick red flags either side of the track and wave flags.
Keep up the line, Bobby!
Steam appears from round a bend in the track.
It's all no good!
Get up the line, Bobby!
It's all no good!
Get back!
Not yet! Not yet!
Bobby stands in the middle of the track. The driver sees the waving flags and hurriedly pushes down a lever.
Stop!
The train stops inches from Bobby. He still stands, eyes closed, waving the flags.
Stop! There's been an earthquake! Don't move, you'll all be killed! The trees are walking down the bank! And there's a mountain of great stones!
What's happening there? What's going on?
Bobby's collapsed on the track. The driver and the fireman carry her to the side of the track and put her down gently. Peter and Phil kneel beside her.
We'll just have a look at this earthquake.
A presentation.
Ladies and gentlemen, I think you will agree with me that we have three charming children here who are indeed an example to us all.
The old man is the speaker at the station.
My chaps, this is it.
One, two, three.
These watches are. And
in the short time I have seen them to look forward to knowing them better. If I had to rename the Waterbury children, I would call them the Three Saviours of the Steel Road, or perhaps the Railway Children. And now, my dears, from the directors of the Northern and Southern Railway, in grateful recognition of a courageous and brave action which averted an accident on August the 15th, 1905.
Oh, thank you.
They receive gold pocket watches. The conductor stops the band once again and once again swaps some of the players' music around.
It's your turn to make a speech now. Just begin with ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, Lord.
No, ladies and gentlemen.
Ladies and gentlemen. Ladies and gentlemen, we shall treasure these watches for the rest of our lives. And what I mean to say is, thank you all very much indeed.
Yeah. Forrest and their mother are there.
One, two.
The The conductor stops the band again, whips the trombonist's music off him and gives it to a cornet player.
You must be very proud, Mrs. Walterley.
I am. And this is from me.
Perks hands Peter his repaired engine. The conductor gives a cocky smile now the band's in tune and turns to the audience on the platform. All have left. The conductor throws down his hat and baton. Mrs. Waterbury, wearing an elegant confection of a hat perched on her head, walks back to the house with her children, past hazy yellow flowers. Night, Bobby and Phil lie on their bed, looking at their watches.
It's a wonderful day, wasn't it? The kind of day that very seldom happens to anybody. But I did so want to talk to the old gentleman about something else.
What did you want to say to him?
I'll tell you. I've written him a letter.
Both girls are in nightdresses. Phil wears her hat.
Dearest old gentleman, I want to ask you something, please. If you get out of the train and go by the next, it would do. I do not want you to give me anything. Mother says we ought not to. And besides, we do not want any things, only to talk to you about a prisoner and captive. Your loving friend, Bobby.
Very good. Yes, it is.
Day. The neatly dressed children sit on the station platform. Phil puts a hand to a sash round her hips as a steam engine puffs towards the station.
My heart's thumping like a steam engine, right under my sash too.
People's hearts aren't under their sashes.
I don't care, mine is.
Well, if you're going to talk like a poetry book, my heart's in my mouth.
My heart's in my boots, if it comes to that. You'll think we're idiots.
You won't be far wrong.
Perks greets the train and opens a door.
Morning, sir. Morning, Perks.
Morning.
The old man.
This is a very great pleasure.
It was good of you to get out.
May I extend a cordial invitation to the use of my room, sir?
Thank you.
Right away, sir. Right away, Mr. Mitchell!
Thank you, Mr. Perks.
If you'd care to follow me, sir. Just along here.
Perks stands aside to let the old man and the children into his room.
Nice and tidy for you, sir.
Thank you, Perks.
I'll leave it to you then, sir.
Thank you.
The old man wears a tall top hat.
Well, what is it?
He sits down.
Oh, well, please.
Yes.
What I mean to say is...
Yes.
I wish I might say something.
I wish you would say something.
Well, then. It's about our Russian.
Captive.
A captive. We want more than anything in the world to find his wife and children for him. Only we don't know how.
What did you say his name was?
I'll write it for you. Do you have a pencil and the back of an envelope?
Here. Write it here.
He hands her a notebook and gold pen. Bobby, wearing a white dress with a sailor suit neckline, writes the name.
This is how you write it. You say Shapansky.
She shows the old man, who sits with his cane out in front of him and his hands folded on the handle.
Man. Bless my soul. I've read his book, and so your mother took him in, like the good Samaritan. I tell you what, youngsters, your mother must be a very good woman.
Yes, she is.
And you're a good man.
You flatter me. Now, am I to tell you what I think of you?
Oh, please don't.
Why?
I don't know why exactly. Only if it's something horrid. I don't want you to. And if it's something nice, I'd rather you didn't.
Well, then, all I will say is that I'm very glad you came to me about all this. Very glad indeed. And I shouldn't be surprised if I don't find out something very soon. Well, now, tell me something about yourselves.
Tea first.
Phil beams at him. A train belches out steam as it winds its way through verdant countryside. The children sit beneath a tree in the buttercup-filled field below their front garden. Peter suddenly sits up.
Who on earth?
A top hat shows through the grass.
Let's go and see.
The dignified old man walks up the field towards them.
Hello. Hello.
Hello. Good news, my dears. I found your Russian friend's wife and children.
And I couldn't resist the temptation of having the pleasure of telling him. No, you tell him, my dear.
Bobby pecks his cheek.
The other two will show me the way.
Schepansky, a blanket over his knees, sits in the garden with Mrs. Waterbury.
Mr. Schepansky's wife and children have been found. Oh, vos femmes et vos enfants sont dégourdis.
Schepansky bows his head. The family and Schepansky see the old man onto a train.
Bye, sir.
Goodbye.
Au revoir.
The old man gets in.
Goodbye. Goodbye.
The waiter shows the old man a bottle. As the train pulls away, the waiter pours champagne for the old man. On the platform, the family, Schepansky and Forrest stand in the sunshine waving. Later, the Waterburys walk home, Bobby and Phil holding their mother's hand. Perk studies the buttercup brooch under a gaslight.
Yeah, that's a likely little brooch, that. You know, I don't know if I've ever seen a thing more like a buttercup without it were a buttercup.
Mother gave it to me for my birthday.
Oh, is that it? I didn't see it close to. It's highly decorative, that. Thank you.
When's your birthday, Mr. Perks?
My birthday? Yeah, I gave up keeping my birthday before you lot were born.
You must have been born sometime, you know, even if it was 20 years ago, or 30 years ago, or 60, or 70.
Yeah, well, it won't go out so long as that, miss. Oh, well.
He throws tea leaves on his fire, putting
what
it out.
Really it's my 42 years. From the 15th of this month.
Why didn't you keep it then?
I've got other things to keep besides birthdays.
Oh, what? Not secrets, Mr. Perks.
No, the kids and the blooming missus.
The children sit in his station room beaming at him as he makes another pot of tea.
I've sold another story, darlings. The one about the king of the mussels. So there'll be buns for tea. You can go and get them the moment they're ready.
Mummy, would you mind if we didn't have buns for tea tonight? But on the 15th, that's next Thursday.
I don't mind when you have them, darling, but why?
Well, it's Perks' birthday. He's 42. He says he doesn't keep his birthday anymore. He's got other things to keep. Not rabbits and secrets, but the kids and the bloomin' missus.
His wife and children, Bobby.
It's the same thing, isn't it?
Bloomin' missus is sort of a germ of endearment, isn't it?
Term of endearment, Phil.
Yes.
We thought we'd make a nice birthday for him. He's been very nice to us, you know. We agreed that next bun day we'd ask if we could.
It would be rather nice to write his name on the buns in pink sugar, wouldn't it?
Perks isn't a very pretty name.
Albert's his other name. I asked him once. I think Albert's a pretty name.
Bobby and Peter look at her as if she's mad.
What's the matter with that?
In a barn.
About flowers.
Well, he's got lots of flowers of his own, hasn't he?
Yes, but it's always nice to be given them.
Let's all just sit and think. No one's to speak until they've thought of something.
Phil stands pensively. Peter fiddles with a pair of pliers. Bobby toys with a piece of straw.
I've got it.
What?
Well, Perks is so nice to everyone, right?
Right.
So there must be lots of people in the village who'd like to help make him a birthday, right?
Mother said we weren't to ask people for things.
Well, for ourselves, she meant, silly, not for other people.
I think we should ask Mummy first.
There's no harm in it. Depends how you do it. I only hope Mr. Perks won't be offended and think it's charity. Poor people can be very proud, you know.
It's not because he's poor. It's because we're fond of him.
All right, I'll look out some things that Phyllis has outgrown. Will that do?
I'm sure he'd love that.
At the post office.
Tomorrow and I'll see what I can do.
Oh, thank you. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
I've always liked Mrs. Ransom.
Oh, yes.
Thank you.
Of course. Yes.
They move to the baker's, then the butcher's. Children head down a street to a cobbler working outside, then to an ironmonger.
Some people were kind, and some were crusty, and some would give, and some would not. It's Mr. Perks' birthday on Thursday. Would you like to give him a present?
No, I would not. I hate the man.
Thank
wow.
you.
That was pretty rude.
It's rather difficult work asking for things, even for other people, as you have no doubt found if you've ever tried it. Tobacco pipe, half a pound of tea.
Woolen scarf from the draper's.
Stuffed squirrel from Dr. Forrest.
Squirrel, right?
There it is. You can have it. Some good riddance to it.
Thank you.
They wheel the gifts off in a pram.
Bye.
Bye.
They arrive at the cobbler's, where a bearded man stands outside and touches his cap politely.
Thank you, Mr.
James. I love that. Thanks.
He gives them a shovel. Bobby shakes the man's hand and they put the gift in the pram and wheel it away past the church and on up a hill to a small stone terraced house. They enter the postage stamp front garden through a small gate. A little boy in an outside privy responds to their calls.
Oh, hello? Hello, is anyone at home?
The mum's upstairs a-changing of herself. Mum, visitors!
Thank you, Patrick. Just coming.
Mrs. Perks comes outside.
I'm a bit late changing, miss, owing to me having had an extra clean-up today, along with Perks happening to say it's his birthday. I don't know what put such an idea into his head. Well, he keeps the children's birthdays, of course. But him and me, well, we've no time for such like as a general rule.
We knew it was his birthday. We brought him some presents.
Oh, bring them in, my dears.
They heave the pram inside. Mrs. Perks wipes tears from her eyes with her long apron.
Please don't, Mrs. Perks. Whatever is the matter? Do you mean to say you don't like the things we brought? Don't you like them?
Oh, there, don't mind me. I'm all right. Like them? Why, it's a birthday such as Perks never had. Not even when he were a boy.
Good. I'm glad you're pleased. Can we wait and see if Mr. Perks is pleased too?
I won't say another word.
Could we have a plate for the buns, Mrs. Perks?
Oh, of course, Missy. Fit for a prince, I'd say. I never thought there'd be anything more for him, oh, except the ounce of his pet particular baccy.
Feeling right today. Been a lovely day.
Bless us. He's early.
Let's hide in there. You tell him about it, but give him the tobacco first since you got it for him. And when you've told him, we'll come out and shout many happy returns.
The children and Perks and numerous children hide.
Hello, woman.
He looks warily at the table.
Oh, here's a pretty set out.
It's your birthday tea, Bert. And here's an ounce of your extra particular.
Yes, you're a good old girl. Hey, what's that pram doing here? Hey, you're not.
She shakes her head. He looks to the table.
What's all these bundles? Hey? And what's all this sweet stuff? And what's this squirrel doing on table?
Oh, Lord. Whatever shall we do? I've forgotten to put the labels on any of the things. You won't know what's from who. You'll think it's all from us. And that we're trying to be grand and charitable or something horrid like that.
Shh, be quiet.
I don't care. I won't stand it. I tell you straight.
But it's them children you make such a fuss about. The children from the Three Chimneys.
I don't care. Not if it was angels from heaven. I've got on all right all these years and no favours asked. I'm not going to begin these sort of charity goings on at my time of life. And don't you think it, Nell.
Oh, shush, Bert. Shut your silly tongue, for goodness sake. The all three of them's in the other room are listening to every word you speaks.
Right, I'll give them something to listen to. Spoke my mind to these before. I'll do it again. Come out. Come on out. Out here. Come on. No, not you lot. You stop in there. Sophie, look, put some pants on Benjamin. We've got company. Right, you can tell me what you mean by it. Have I ever complained to you of being short as you start this charity with me?
We thought you'd be so pleased, Mr. Perks. I'll never try and be kind to anyone else as long as I live. No, I won't. Not never.
Didn't mean any harm.
It isn't what you mean so much as what you does.
We thought you'd love it. We always have things on our birthdays.
Oh, aye, from your own relations. That's different.
No, not just our relations.
They're from all sorts of people in the village.
And who put them up to it, I'd like to know.
We did.
Perks eyes them sternly. The children and Mrs. Perks stand sheepishly. Looking wounded, Perks sits down.
So you've been going round telling the neighbours that we can't make both ends meet. Well, now you've disgraced us as deep as you can in the neighbourhood. You can just take that old pack of tricks back where it came from. I'm very much obliged, I'm sure. I don't doubt but what you meant it kind, but I'd rather not be acquainted with you any longer. It's all the same to you.
Perks turns his chair away from them and stares at the wall.
We'll go if you like. And you needn't be friends with us anymore if you don't want to. But before
we'll always be friends with you, even though you're nasty to us.
But before we go, do let us show you these labels that we brought to put on the things.
I don't want to see no labels except proper luggage labels in my own walk of life.
Please let Bobby show you the labels.
Oh, all right, go on.
Well, then,
We wrote down everything everybody said when they gave us the things the people's names on. Because Mother said that we ought to be careful. Because, well, I wrote down what she said, and you'll see. That's from Mother. She thought Mrs. Perks might like some of Phyllis's things.
I can't do much. Well, that's all right. I mean, your ma's a born lady. We'll keep the little frocks and whatnot, Nell.
Yes, Albert. Then there's the perambulator and the gooseberries and sweets. They're from Mrs. Ransom.
I can't send the pram back, Bert, and I won't. So don't ask.
I'm not asking anything.
Then there's the shovel. Mr. James made that for you himself. And he says... Oh, where is it? Ah, yes, here.
No, you can read it.
He says... You tell Mr. Perks, it is a pleasure to make a little trifle for a man as is so much respected.
Yeah, he was a good chap, that. He's a very good chap, that. He's not bad at all, that chap.
And everybody who gave anything said they liked you, and that they thought it was a very good idea of ours. And nobody said anything about charity or anything horrid like that. And we thought that you'd love to know how fond everybody is of you. I've never been so unhappy in all my born days. Goodbye. Come on.
Stop! I take back every word I've said, contrary to what you'd wish. Nell?
Yes, Albert?
Put Gettle on.
We'll take away the things if you're unhappy with them.
I'm not unhappy about them. I don't know as I was ever better pleased. Not so much with the presents, though, frankly, they are an A1 collection, but... The kind respect by our neighbours. That's worth having, I know.
I think it's all worth having. And you've made a most ridiculous fuss about nothing, Bert, if you ask me.
No, I haven't. If a man didn't respect himself, nobody wouldn't do it for him.
But everyone respects you. They all said so.
We knew you'd like it once you understood.
Well, you'll stay to tea, I take it.
May the garland of friendship be evergreen. May our garland of friendship be evergreen, Mr. Perks. Here,
here, here. Oh, well, that's all right then, isn't it? Have a look at them buns you brought in. Where are they? What's that?
Rosa, it's Albert.
Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners now and at the hour of our death. Amen. Amen.
Mrs. Perks, dressed in a nightdress and wearing her hair in curling rags, stands at the bottom of an iron bedstead. She ends her prayers by making the sign of the cross and turns to a cot in the same room.
Now go to sleep, all of you, and not another word.
A shawl draped round her, she puts out the gaslight and leaves the room.
Good night. Good night, Mum.
Yeah, they're jolly good little kids, those Waterburys.
They're all right, bless their hearts. It's you that's the aggravatingest old thing that ever was. I was ashamed of you, I tell you.
Yeah, well, you needn't be, old girl. I climbed down handsome as soon as I understood it wasn't charity. Charity's one thing I never could have barred, and I won't neither.
Oh, go to sleep, Albert.
Yes, dear.
He finishes beer.
It isn't what you do so much as what you means. That's what I say. Now, if it had been charity...
Oh, drat charity, Bert. Nobody won't offer you charity, however much you was to want it.
No.
That were just friendliness, that were. I reckon it's what people call loving kindness. Now go to sleep, Bert.
Yes, dear. Good night.
Good night, Bert. Happy birthday.
He reaches up to turn out a gaslight, then draws curtains round the bed. A lamp burns on a table outside the curtains.
Now?
Oh, all right, Bert. As it's your birthday.
He reaches for a bottle on the table and removes the cork with his teeth. He spits the cork out. Heads towards the Waterburys on his tricycle and trailer. He picks up a parcel from the trailer and hesitates as he's about to go through the stile. He lifts the parcel above the stile with ease and proceeds to the house.
Hello, my dears. Hard at it, are you? One good turn deserves another, that's what I always say.
Hello, Mr. Perks. How do you mean?
Well, I found these magazines, you see, in the waiting room. I was cleaning up, and they're in a cupboard, and... Well, they're only collecting dust, and...
Dust is, as you know, unhygienic. Hello?
Hello.
I thought perhaps you might like them. There's a lot of pictures in them, and you can colour them up with chalks and that. Anyway, I don't want them.
You're a dear.
Yes, you are. Here, here.
Oh, well, that's all right, then. Well, I must be getting along. I've got lots to do. Perks must be about it.
Thank you. That was brilliant of him. I think we'd better go inside. It's going to rain.
Phil and Peter obey and dash inside. Bobby looks down at the newspaper-wrapped bundle Perks has brought. Her father's face looks out at her from a photograph. Shocked, Bobby crouches slowly to take a closer look. An article is headed, Charles Waterbury, End of Trial Verdict. Sentence, 5 years penal servitude. Bobby stares down at the newspaper miserably. Drops of rain fall on his photograph. Bobby enters the house, clutching the bundle. Bobby goes to the bedroom she shares with Phil and puts the bundle on the bed. Breathing heavily, she sits on the bed, stares at the bundle, then lowers her head and presses her face against her father's photograph as she weeps. Mrs. Waterbury cuts bread.
Where's Bobby?
I thought I heard her upstairs.
She knows it's tea time. What if she's worried?
She goes through a door and to the bottom of the stairs.
Bobby?
Bobby sits up slowly and wipes a tear away. She turns the bundle over to conceal the photograph and puts it behind her. A concerned Mrs. Waterbury is outside on the landing. She pauses briefly, then marches briskly into the room. Bobby's back is to her.
What is it, darling?
She turns with tear-soaked cheeks. Bobby turns over the bundle to reveal the photograph and the article. Mrs. Waterbury fixes Bobby with an anxious stare, then hurriedly sits beside her daughter on the bed.
You don't believe Daddy did it?
No!
Because it's not true. They have shut him in prison, but he's done nothing wrong.
He's good and honourable, and he belongs to us.
Would it make you very unhappy if you told me all about it? I want to understand.
Mrs. Waterbury gets up and leans over the iron bedstead to Bobby as she speaks.
Do you remember the day those two men came to the house and took Daddy away?
Yes, I do.
Well, they arrested him, charging him with selling state secrets, with being, in fact, a spy and a traitor.
How could anyone believe that? How could anyone do such a thing?
Someone did.
Why didn't you tell someone? A lawyer. There wasn't anyone who'd hurt Daddy on purpose, was there?
Oh, I don't know. It's all so complicated.
She sits down again.
A man in the office who was very envious of your father. And said he didn't quite trust him.
Why didn't she explain all that to someone?
No one would listen. Do you suppose I haven't tried everything? No, my darling. What we have to do, you and I, and Daddy, is to be brave.
She kisses Bobby on the cheek gently. Bobby returns the kiss and composes herself by taking a large breath. Phil's asleep in bed. Bobby sits dressed on the edge of the bed and places a letter and her father's newspaper photo into an envelope. Bobby creeps out in her hat and coat. On a plot beside the station, Perks, holding strings between his teeth, ties runner bean plants to canes. Bobby runs across the track to him in the sunshine and hands him the letter. He reads the writing on it and nods. Bobby leaves again. Perks slips the envelope inside his jacket.
Where have you been?
Where have I been? Down to the station, but don't ask me why. It's a secret.
Oh, please yourself.
There's going to be a paper chase tomorrow.
Whoopee!
Who? The grammar school boys.
Sippy!
Perks says we can see them go along the line.
Oh, really? What's a paper chase?
Bobby's smile fades. A teenage lad carries a bag over his shoulder and scatters coloured paper as he runs down a street, then down the railway embankment, passing the children. Other boys follow the trail he makes at some distance.
Let me pass, please.
He runs into the tunnel. Two railway men are walking out of it.
Hey, that's against bylaws. I ought to report him.
They're only having fun.
Passengers is forbidden to cross the line on any pretense.
He ain't no passenger. He's out of sight now anyway. What the eye don't see, the eye need take no notice of. That's what I always say.
Come on, then. It's gone in twelve. Hey! Oh, it is dark in here.
The children watch as the other boys, wearing breeches and tops, follow the trail and run into the tunnel.
They don't know what they're in for. It isn't easy running in dark.
They'll take a long time going through, won't they?
Aye, they will, but...
A lad in a red jersey who's lagging behind slips as he descends the embankment. He gets up and scans about.
They went that way.
Oh, thanks.
I know. Let's cut across to the top and see them come out the other end. We'll be there before they are.
Good idea.
Yes, good idea.
The children run up the embankment across a grassy field and to a wooden fence which they clamber over. All three carry little bundles of something wrapped in hankies. The children stop briefly and flop down onto the grass on their knees. Moments later, they get up and make their way down the steep, grassy slope above the mouth of the tunnel. They stand looking over the stone wall above it. Eventually, the paper chasers begin to emerge. The paper trail leads out of the tunnel and up the other side of the embankment. The children watch a string of runners struggle up the steep slope.
There, that's all. What should we do now?
Not yet. There's one in the red jersey. He hasn't come out yet.
Come on, let's go to the tunnel mouth and perhaps we can see him from the inside.
Phil and Peter run down the lumpy grass path to the tunnel mouth. Bobby follows them.
It's dark in there.
Don't worry, Phil. I'll protect you.
I don't like it.
Still no sign of him. I reckon he must have had an accident. Let's go and rescue him. Come on.
Come on, Phil. Keep close behind me. If a train comes along, get flat against the tunnel wall and hold your skirts against you. I still don't like it.
Some way in, an oil lamp hangs on the tunnel wall, casting a gloomy light. The children stop beside it and peer ahead. Phil clings to Bobby's arm.
Shh, don't be silly. What is that?
It's another earthquake!
Further down the tunnel, the boy in the red jersey lies with his back against the wall and his right leg stretched out. His ankle rests on the line and there's a bloody gash on his calf. The boy looks barely conscious.
It's a train.
Oh, let me go back!
Don't be a coward, it's quite safe. Stand back.
Come in. Come on.
They huddle in an alcove in the tunnel wall. The boy hears the train whistle. The train enters the tunnel. The boy struggles to grab his leg and pull his foot off the line. He succeeds in the nick of time and the train rolls by. Smoke and steam clear from the tunnel.
Come on.
Supposing that boy was caught underneath the train.
Oh, we've got to go and see.
Can't we go and get someone from the station?
Phil, you wait here.
No. Hello?
Peter takes the lamp and leads the way.
Hey, you two, come quickly!
The boy is curled up.
Oh, is that blood? Is that red blood? Is he all killed?
Phyllis, please. Hurry up, you two, get help.
Later, the two railway men carry the boy on a makeshift stretcher towards the Waterbury's house. He lies with his eyes closed and the blanket over him. Bobby runs on ahead and into the house where her mother is writing.
It was on a hot summer's
afternoon.
Oh, do come down. We found a hound in a red jersey in the tunnel, and he's broken his leg. They're bringing him here. I've sent for Dr. Forrest.
But you should send for a vet. I can't have a lame dog here.
Oh, he's not a dog. It's a boy.
Well, then he ought to be taken to his mother.
His mother's dead. His father's in Northumberland. Oh, Mother, you will be nice to him, won't you? I told him I was sure you'd want us to have him here. Oh, you always want to help everybody.
Come along.
The boy lies on the kitchen table.
Glad you brought him here. Let's get him to bed before the doctor comes.
It'll hurt a bit, won't it? I hope you don't think I'm a coward if I faint again. I honestly and truly don't do this on purpose. And I don't want to cause you any more trouble.
Don't you worry. You're the one who's got the trouble. We'd love to have you here. Wouldn't we, Bobby?
Yes.
The family polish brass.
That'll be Dr. Forrest. I'll go.
Mrs. Vine is still polishing as the children sit listening to their mother's conversation.
That's not the doctor. I know.
I know that voice, though. At least I think I do.
I thought I recognized it, too. It's not the doctor, that's for sure. Could it be? Perhaps Dr. Forrest has been attacked by a highwayman and left for dead, and this is the man who telegraphed to take his place.
Perhaps he's gone mad. Perhaps he's caught something awful from one of his patients, and that man's come to tell her.
Nonsense. Mother wouldn't take the man into Jim's bedroom. Why should she?
Listen. The door's opening.
The children go and listen at a glass-paned door, which Peter opens a crack.
Now they'll come down. It's rude to listen like this. It's not listening. Nobody in their senses would talk secrets on the stairs.
Bobby? A relative of Jim's has come. He wants to see you. Wash your hands and faces. We'll be in the dining room when you're ready.
Yes, Mama.
There now. Fancy not thinking of that, hmm?
Any hot water, Mrs. Viney?
Right-o, love.
The children rush to the sink. Mrs. Viney washes Peter's face and dries it for him.
All right. There we are. That's it.
The children enter the dining room.
Well, I never did.
This, my dears, is Jim's grandfather.
Our own old gentleman. I'm so awfully glad it's you. When I just think of all the old gentlemen there are in the world, it could have been anyone.
You're not going to take Jim away, though, are you?
Not at present. Your mother has most kindly consented to let him stay here. I thought of sending a nurse, but your mother is good enough to say that she will nurse him herself.
What about her writing? You won't have anything to eat if Mother doesn't write.
That's all right, Peter.
I see you trust your children.
Of course.
Then I may tell them our little arrangement. Sit down, my dears.
The girls curtsy. Peter bows.
Your mother, my dears, has consented to give up her writing for a while and to become a matron of my hospital.
Does that mean we'll have to leave Three Chimneys and the railway and everything?
No, no, my darling, no.
The hospital is here. The Three Chimneys Hospital. And my unlucky Jim is the only patient.
Will Mother go on writing again?
We shall see. Perhaps something nice will happen and she won't have to.
But I like my writing.
I know. Don't be afraid I'm going to try and interfere, but one never knows. Very beautiful and wonderful things do happen, don't they? And we live most of our lives in the hope of them.
The old gentleman puts on his top hat as Bobby sees him out of the house and closes the front door behind them.
I got your letter, my dear, but it wasn't needed. When I read about your father's case in the papers at the time, I had my doubts. And ever since I've known who you were, I've been trying to find out things. And I have hopes.
Oh.
Yes, I may say, great hopes. But keep your secret for a little while longer. Wouldn't do to upset your mother with a false hope, would it?
But it isn't false. I know you can do it. I knew you could when I wrote. It isn't a false hope, is it?
No, my dear.
And you don't believe Daddy did it? Oh, say you don't believe he did.
My dear, I'm perfectly certain he didn't.
He raises his hat to her, smiles, and walks down towards a small garden gate. He turns briefly and waves. Bobby beams and heads back to the front door. She shares a final look with the old gentleman.
Life at Three Chimneys was never quite the same again after the old gentleman came to see us.
Phil tends to Jim.
Please, Phyllis.
The house became a hospital.
Drawing on Jim's plaster cast.
I'll give you three guesses who that is.
It's Jim.
Is everything all right? Good luck. I'll curtain off.
Jim watches characters moved on cardboard sticks.
Have you noticed? The ship is sinking.
Yes, I know, but don't blame me.
Get down.
Oh, no, they'll all get so wet.
You'll need some light on the subject.
As your solicitor, I must advise you.
A character riding an elephant.
Don't worry, I've managed to get most of the survivors.
Right, curtain down. Thank you. Good evening.
The curtain lowers on their toy theatre and Jim applauds. The cardboard curtain rises again and the children's faces peer out.
I hope you enjoyed it.
Another time, the children sit around Jim looking bored. He lies in bed and closes a book.
Children, will you please be quiet?
Blood.
Phyllis weeps as Dr. Forrest cuts Jim's plaster off.
Goodness.
Oh, you are a good doctor.
Can I have that,
there
please?
There we are. How's that?
Cheerio.
Bye.
Jim's leg got better and he went home.
Right away, Mr. Mitchell.
Thank you, Mr. Burke.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Bye. I'll write.
Jim and Bobby hold hands through the window.
Oh, Lammy, Pete. They'll have to marry now.
Lammy.
Bobby stands apart from them all as the train steams off.
There seemed to be hardly railway children at all in those days. And as the days went on, each of us had an uneasy feeling about this, which Phyllis expressed one day.
I wonder if the railway misses us. We never go and see it now.
It seems ungrateful. We loved it so when we hadn't anyone to play with. The thing I don't like is our having stopped waving to the 9:15 and sending our love to Father by it.
Let's begin again tomorrow.
A steam train puffs through sunny countryside. The children run through fields. Phil stops to tie her boot. They reach their fence.
Take our love to Father.
Take our love to Father.
They wave their hankies. The children look down and see people leaning out of carriages, waving hankies wildly at them. As the train glides past, the old gentleman in his usual position at the rear of the last carriage stands leaning out of a window and smiling. He holds a newspaper in one hand and points to the paper with his other hand.
Most extraordinary.
Most extraordinary.
Extraordinary indeed.
Now, Bobby, I wonder whether you can...
Bobby daydreams.
Don't you feel well? I don't know. I don't know how I feel. Will you let me off lessons today? I feel as if I want to be quite alone. By myself. Of course I'll let you off.
Bobby gets up from a table with a globe on it and leaves the room. Mrs. Waterbury follows her.
What is it? You don't feel ill, do you?
No, not ill. I've just got to be alone. Do you know?
Sometimes, Roberta, you're so like me.
Bobby puts on a coat. She opens the front door.
I'll be more alive in the garden.
She puts on her hat and smiles. Bobby walks down to the station. On the platform...
Morning, Mrs. Roberta.
Thank you.
The people are reading newspapers.
Hello. Look, if this is a train, it'll be smart work. God bless you, my dear. I've seen it in the papers. I don't know I was ever so pleased with anything in all my born days. One I must have, and no offence I know on a day like this. And one for luck. Now, you ain't offended, are you? Haven't taken too great a liberty, have I, on a day like this, you know?
No, Mr. Perks. Of course it's not a liberty.
No.
Dear Mr. Perks, we love you quite as much as if you're an uncle of our own.
Hey!
But on a day like what?
Well, like this here. I told you I seen it in the papers, didn't I? I told you!
So what in the papers?
Hogworth! Hogworth!
Perks greets the train with gusto. Steam billows. Perks opens a door.
Thank you, madam. Yes. Thank you. Quick as you can, please. Oakwood Station!
Perks looks pointedly to a door which is shrouded in steam. When the door has closed, Perks gives the instruction for the train to leave. He taps the train with the rolled newspaper he's holding and swaggers back to the doorway of his room. Wearing a triumphant smile, he glances across at Bobby, then goes inside. Bobby stands staring at a cloud of steam which billows as the train trundles away. A figure begins to emerge as the steam slowly clears and reveals her father standing on the platform. Carrying a Gladstone bag, he takes a tentative step forward. They hold each other's gaze. Then Bobby breaks into a run.
Daddy! My daddy!
He remains where he is and drops his bag as she flings herself into his arms. They hug tightly and he lifts her off the floor. They part a little and stare at each other. Then Waterbury kisses her on both cheeks. Mr. Waterbury and Bobby walk with their arms around each other. They walk up the field towards the garden gate. Mrs. Waterbury looks out from behind lace curtains upstairs and smiles. She leaves the window. Bobby and her father make their way up the garden path, and Bobby runs inside the house. Mr. Waterbury remains outside and scans the pretty flower beds in front of the house. He then surveys the house itself and slowly makes his way up the short flight of stone steps to the front door. He pauses at the top. Bobby steps out again, beaming. Her father steps inside and slowly shuts the door. Smiling, Bobby walks down into the garden as Phil and Peter run out from behind the house and onto the front lawn. Bobby speaks to them and they make to run towards the house, but Bobby stops them, puts her arms around their shoulders, and steers them away from the house and towards the garden gate.
I think just now, we're not wanted there. Not for a few minutes, anyway. I think it would be best for us to go quickly and quietly. We'll go to the end of the field, among the thin gold spikes of grass. We may just take one last look over our shoulders at the house where neither we nor anyone else is wanted now.
A waving crowd gathered on the railway line. IDFC audio description by Helen Vasey.